Welcome to Acidic Features Podcast, brought to you by Acidic Film Productions. All right, let's get this started. All right, welcome everybody to Acidic Features Podcast. It is hosted by me, Eli Fridley, and I'm here along with my co-hosts, Connor Ayers and Murphy. Today we have a very special guest, the one and only Tommy Chong. So Tommy, before we get started, is there anything you would like to promote or, you know, any new projects or anything that you'd like to talk about?
Well, we got a couple of things. We got my Tommy Chong CBD products.
Awesome.
That are helping a lot of ladies sleep at night. And eventually we got Cheech and Chong dispensaries on the way.
Really? That's awesome.
They're going to be, we're going to start in San Francisco, where it all began. And then we're going to branch out around the world. I got, what else? Yeah, that's all I want to promote right now. We got a few, we got a documentary of Cheech and Chong coming out.
Oh, that's awesome. Definitely going to see that. That's awesome.
Yeah. And we're moving along. You know, when you get my age, you got to keep moving so you stay alive. You know?
Yeah. All right. Awesome. All right. So let's get started. So for segment one, the 6-question interview to start it off, I will ask you a couple questions. And I believe Jake and Connor or Murphy will ask you a question as well as after I'm done with the first 5. And so the first one is, what or who was your biggest influence for your acting career and your pursuit into filmmaking?
Well, I guess Cheech was my biggest influence.
He was the one who really wanted to do it?
Yeah. Well, what happened, you know, until I met Cheech, I was floundering around, you know, in bands, you know, trying to be a black musician. You know? But the minute I met Cheech and we decided, we found out we could do comedy together, it changed my life.
Really?
And meeting Cheech allowed me to do the albums, you know, the record Cheech and Chong albums.
Right.
And it allowed us to do movies and allowed us to have one of the top grossing movies, the time we did it, 1978, I believe.
Yes.
So, And plus Cheech as an actor is a director's dream,
right?
You know, because he, especially with my technique, you know, which is improvisational theater, and Cheech is probably the best I've ever worked with for sure, and it was our partnership that allowed us to do movies.
Right.
And so I really got to credit Cheech and Lou Adler, the producer of the movie.
Yeah. Awesome. Awesome. That was a great answer.
I have one side note question.
Sure.
What made you pursue comedy as like a form of expressing yourself is what it seems? Because
it was kind of accidental. Well, everything is accidental. I got fired from Motown. For trying to get a green card, because the people at Motown, especially the road managers, they didn't they weren't aware of what a green card meant, you know, which is our ability for Canadians to work in the States. And so when I got fired, it kind of soured me on the movie business. Right. I mean, on the music business, because up until then I was in charge of everything. You know, it was, it was my club that we formed the group out of, and I wrote the song, you know, that made us a hit. And then all of a sudden I get fired by some underling for something that was ridiculous. And so I realized that, you know, I better get something going where I can't get fired.
Right. Awesome.
And so when I met Cheech and we were doing comedy, And we could perform in front of like rock and roll kids.
Right.
Right then I said, well, that's what really got me into it. And because I'm the kind of guy, I'm not really that expert at anything, but I can learn, you know, and I learned how to do everything. I learned how to play guitar without a music teacher. I learned how to do direct movies without going to film school.
Right.
The secret, anyway, the secret is being around people more talented than you are.
Okay, so you can always learn and like just progress.
Exactly. Exactly.
Awesome. That's why
when you go into any, well, first of all, everything we do in life depends on somebody else. Even if you're a loner, it also depends on someone allowing you to be a loner.
Right.
You know, we're not in a bubble by no means. And so, what I learned that if you want to be success at anything, you got to be around people that are better than you.
Okay.
I've always told myself that, like, I hate being told, like, oh, yeah, you're right. I like your ideas. Like, I want somebody around me that's going to be like, well, what about this? Or like, hey, let's, you know, let me give you my insight on this. That's exactly. People I want to surround myself with.
Exactly. You can never get comfortable because there's always something to learn. And the other thing I learned, you know, like when I look at my career, especially when people introduce me, you know, I laugh because, I'm a high school dropout.
Yeah.
And not only once, I dropped out of high school twice. And, you know, the first time I dropped out, I didn't know what I wanted to do. So I ended up being a roofer.
Really?
And I used to watch my classmates, ex-classmates, go to school. And I'd been on the roof for 4 hours by the time they went to school. And then I'd watch them come home from school. And I had another 4 hours to do on the roof. So I decided, you know, maybe school's not such a bad idea. And so I went back to school. And then I discovered marijuana.
Nice.
and music. The blues,
right?
And so then I realized that, you know, what I want to do really is learn how to play the blues, and you don't need a lot of schooling for that. And so I hit the road, and everything's worked out.
That's awesome. All right, question two: when you made your first film, did you expect to become one of the biggest pioneers in stoner filmmaking, or for your career to be as successful as it has become?
Well, to tell you the truth, everything I do, I don't know where it came from, but I've always had this feeling that whatever I do is really, really going to shake up the world.
Right. That's a good feeling, though.
It's sort of like, to give you an example, we were in England with my band, and I was that's when I was playing rhythm and blues, and we were in England backing up one of Barry Motown acts, Chris Clark. Anyway, we were playing in this little club, and all of a sudden Jimi Hendrix walks in the door, and he walks up to the stage and he asks me. He knew me from Seattle. He knew the band because we were playing before Jimmy was playing. And so Jimmy kind of knew us from the old days. Anyway, he walks up to the stage. He says, hey, do you mind if I sit in? And so I played with Jimi Hendrix because he didn't play guitar. He wanted to play bass because we never had a left-handed guitar there for him. And so I literally played with Jimi Hendrix. And then the next day we're riding in a limo and we're on our way to the airport, and everybody in the band was talking about Jimi Hendrix. And then for some reason I said, I'm going to be bigger than Jimi Hendrix someday. I just blurted it out. I mean, and everybody in the band looked at me like, what? You know, you barely can play guitar and you're going to be better than Jimi Hendrix? And the drummer said, what, playing guitar? And I said, no, not necessarily guitar. I had a flash. I had a flash right then. And I've had these flashes my whole life. Is that so when you ask about did I think Up in Smoke was going to be, I thought it was even going to be bigger than that.
Really?
Bigger than what it was. Yes, I did. Because as we were shooting, I kept seeing so many laughs in the movies.
Right.
You know, and you don't see that, especially scripts, because when you script something out, it's hard to get, you know, to do any more with comedy than describe what you want to see.
Right.
But when you're writing, you can write drama, you can write conflict, you can write all that. So a lot of scripts are loaded with really good writing stuff. But as far as comedy goes, they usually, you know, it's tough for a lot of writers to write comedy, you know, because it's hard to write. But when you're performing, it's like playing a trick on somebody, you know, April Fool's gag.
Right.
You know, it's hard to write that down. You know what I mean?
It is,
you
have yeah.
to, yeah, you say, okay, you do this, you do that, you know?
Yeah, but that's why down, I want, if you like, RP plays improv.
Yeah, if you wrote it down, it would look stupid. So, I really did. I knew we had something really special.
That's awesome. That's awesome. That's really good to hear. All right. And then question three, were you originally wanting the band you were associated with in the 1960s, Little Daddy and the Bachelors, which I believe was originally called The Shades, to become your future career? Or did you always know you would part ways with the band and pursue something different?
Yeah, you know, all of us were music illiterate when we joined up. Mm-hmm. It was very serendipity. You know, it was like, it was something ordained to happen. Like, I never planned to play the blues. I just ended up playing the blues.
That's awesome.
Because the singer, who was a football player, we were all more jocks than we were musicians.
Really?
The singer was a running back, really phenomenal running back. He would have played the pros if he hadn't messed up his knee and got into singing. And he was black. He was a black Canadian. The piano player, again, was another athlete. He was more of a bodybuilder, but he also played football. My brother, who played bass, was a linebacker. The saxophone player was also a lineman, I think. And the drummer on our first band was a white guy, all college. And none of us had any kind of musical experience, like playing music as a living experience. We all had to learn. And when you learn the way we did, and so what we did a lot of gymnastics, a lot of flips and a lot of athletic moves while we played.
That's awesome.
And that kind of hit our music talent, you know, it sort of enhanced it. And so we got really popular. As the Vancouver's, as the Shades, really popular. But then people grow, and as you grow up, you grow out of things. And everybody kind of grew out of that initial, it wasn't a boy band, it was more like a thug band.
That's awesome.
We're the kind of guys that, you know, if anybody messed with us, we'd jump off the stage and beat the shit out of them, you know.
Yeah. Like Motley Crue's first show.
Yeah, we were the first punk band, really.
That's awesome. But
we played the blues. We played the blues. And being a mixed group, you know, with black musicians and that in Canada, which was very racist and still is, we had our share of conflict, you know, when it comes to duking it out with people. But I didn't know. I really wasn't sure that I was even going to be a musician. It was with music was something that I could do, you know. And I wasn't dedicated in any way at all. But I never learned to sing until I was in my 50s, 60s, you know, before I learned how to sing. You know, and then I end up on The Masked Singer. You know, I never directed or even thought of directing a movie until I directed a movie.
That's crazy.
But it's like anything, you know, when you're from Canada, especially in the country, you learn to do everything because there's nobody to call. and the ones you do call, they're your neighbors, and it has to be something serious. But any labor or trying to fix your car or anything, or teach you music, you're on your own, dude, you know. And so I carried that into my profession, you know, just right. Do it yourself.
Awesome. Okay. Great answer. All right. And then number four. All right. So if you could do a sequel to any movie you starred in or created, what movie would that be?
Good question.
Thank you.
Sequel. Well, you know, Up in Smoke was meant to be a sequel.
Right.
Yeah, because originally Up in Smoke, which was directed by Lou Adler, I directed it. I directed most of it because it was improv. And so when he felt that he had a movie, he sort of barred me from the set kind of thing.
Okay.
And they put on his own ending. And the ending was really bad. It was terrible because it was like all a dream ending.
Right.
I changed the ending and made it so that we rode off into the sunset so there could be a sequel.
Okay.
So it would be Up in Smoke would be the sequel.
That's awesome. I would love to see like an Up in Smoke sequel, especially with you and Cheech now and like you guys find yeah. each other randomly. That'd be amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. That would be the sequel.
That would be awesome. All right. And then question five, what is something you've always wanted to be asked in an interview or talk about, but no one's ever brought up before?
How much money do you want to pay me?
Yeah, that's a pretty good one. Dude, honestly, yeah. If I had the money, I would like pay anyone as much as I possibly could, because if I had the money and I was able to give it, I 100% would. When I had a job, I was constantly buying my friends things because I could.
Yeah, of course. Of course.
I don't want to spend it on myself. It's like, nah, dude, you want this? Here you go. I'd buy him movies and video games. I was about to buy my friend Bo an air fryer because he wanted one. I'm like, dude, I can.
Well, you got the secret of success there.
Yeah.
You see? Like when people, like I have had a couple of guitar collections stolen. And people think, oh, you must have been really pissed off. And I said, on the contrary.
Right.
Because you steal my guitar, then I get a chance to buy a new one.
That's awesome. Yeah.
That's sick. The great thing about being non-materialistic. It's things yeah. like that, because you can always just go and get another one.
Yeah. Or make another one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That'd be awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. And being generous is a very, very serious attribute that you need, but a lot of people don't have, especially the rich people.
Oh yeah, that's really like,
because the richer they get, the more greedy or more closed in they get, you know.
I mostly hang around stoners, and I love this phrase that you said in 2019 during a stand-up show, that marijuana is the only drug that will make you pass it as soon as you hit it.
That's true. Isn't that true?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, that party I had, or that time I met Jimi Hendrix, we all went up to our apartment, our hotel room after the gig. And I thought I was going to be partying with Hendrix, man.
Right.
And instead, he went in the bathroom and he stayed in the bathroom the whole time.
Really?
It must have been 2 hours. He stayed in the bathroom. And then when he left, he just left right from the bathroom, went home, because he was in there doing his heroin.
Yeah. Jeez. Okay. I do have a side question about Hendrix, because it's technically a myth as of right now. So everyone knows he would sometimes put acid, like liquid LSD, on his bandana and when he was playing. But it's also said that he would cut his forehead sometimes so it would be able to go in faster. Is that true? Do you know if that's true?
No idea. I doubt it. I doubt it very much, because Hendrix was more than acid. He was heroin.
Right.
And he had all the heroin attributes.
Okay.
No, he's it's a sad thing, you know. But he was only you know, use the bright star, like a lot of them, you know, they shine really bright, then they die. Mm-hmm. Shooting stars, you know, that's what they do.
Yeah.
And that's what he was. No, I don't think, I don't, you know, Hendrix wasn't, Hendrix was just another incredible guitar player until he met the girl from the UK.
Really?
And she got him singing. He wasn't a singer before. He was just a player. She got him singing. She got him writing songs. And she got him, got the look. Before that, he was a Goonie looking, Motown looking guy, you know.
That's awesome.
And she, it was always, it was women. If you got girlfriends, always listen to, you know, them if they got fashion conscious.
Right.
Because the Beatles never made it until they met the girl that told them how to dress, how to look.
Yeah.
And so she got them looking like male models. And that was the reason why the girls were screaming so loud.
Yeah.
You know?
Because they looked like a good, like a boy band. All the girls wanted them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And that's what boy bands are all about, you know?
Yeah.
And by the way, for the most part, that's what music is all about.
Yeah, it really is.
It makes separates you from the crowd.
Yeah,
and
it puts you above the top.
And music has that power to hypnotize.
Oh, yeah. It seems like it's that way with all companies nowadays, where it's the public look that matters more than
rather than what you actually want to
people.
Do.
Yeah.
Always, yeah.
So, hey, Tommy.
That's why art is so important, you know, because it's the art that catches the eye.
Right.
So, yeah. Tommy, I have about a few questions for you. I have to leave early because I actually have.
You got to go to your parole
sucks,
officer.
But I wish I could talk more. Now I got to go to my work. I work at Dollar Tree. So it's, yeah.
Okay.
So if you don't mind, I have about three questions for you, and then I'm going to dip.
Okay.
So my first question is, so over the years from when you started smoking, do you think that the potency of marijuana has changed or like strengthened?
Yes, it probably has because it's cleaner.
Mm-hmm.
It's cleaner and but don't discount the stuff that they grew in Asia and Afghanistan.
Right.
You know, that's where indica came from. It grows in the mountain. Now, some of that weed back in the day, man, would paralyze you. You know, and they made it into hash. And so hash is just marijuana compressed. You know,
right?
And so, yes and no. The marijuana today is cleaner, and because of cross-pollination and all that stuff, it's probably you probably increase the THC level probably quite a bit. However, it's not how much you have,
right?
It's what you do with what you have,
right?
You see. Mm-hmm. And so I discovered now that the old weed that I find, you know, every once in a while you'll find a bag of weed you forgot about. And it,
I don't know
and
about
it's
a whole
almost,
bag of weed, but I'll almost, find like a little bit.
Yeah, it's almost dust, you know.
Yeah.
Well, with me, I got bags of weed and it's almost dust.
Yeah.
Well, rather than, you know, just cook with it or throw it out or sell it to unsuspecting people, I tried it and I've been experimenting with it and I found that the lesser powerful weed allows me to be more creative for a longer period of time than the real, you know, put you in a coma type of weed. So it's not how strong it is, man. It's what you, how little you do to get to where you need to be.
Okay.
Okay. That was awesome. I like that answer.
Yeah. So my next question is, so let me read. I can't read that. Oh, there we go. So what is like the major thing when you were younger that you wanted to be remembered for? Like if you died tomorrow, like what would you want people to remember you by? Like what, like entrepreneurship, like career wise, stuff like that?
That's a tough question. Well, first of all, I don't put that, I don't have any. I don't mind the thought of dying now. Mm-hmm. But I know for a fact that the only thing you take with you into the grave is your reputation. So the question is very valid. So I think the only thing I would like people to say to me is that, you know, that dude was always smiling.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, I've never seen you mad or anything like that. Like, it's like you've always just spreading, you know, nothing but happiness or like, you know, just productivity and everything.
Yeah, yeah. I just being content.
Right.
You know, when Jesus left, he said to his disciples, he said, "My peace I give unto you."
Right.
And that is that to me, that's the most valuable thing on the planet. Is being able to be satisfied with your life and who you are and what you're doing.
Right.
You know, to be really say, and that's what makes you smile. That's what makes me smile, because I learned, you know, there's a spiritualist that I read all the time. His name is Emmett Fox, F-O-X-X. Emmett, E-M-M-O-T-T, Fox. He is a spiritualist that died quite a few years ago, actually. But when you read his stuff, you think you wrote it yesterday or today. So I follow his program, you know, and it's so enlightening, and so you talk about the peace. That's the peace that reading his books, because what he does more than anything, he validates my inner thoughts, what I really feel, and then all of a sudden, he agrees with me, kind of thing, you know?
Right.
I have a side note question. Me and my mom are really big readers, and she's looking into Emmett Fox right now. What book would you recommend by him?
Anyone. Try the Ten Commandments. It's one of my favorites. Let's see, what's the one I got? There's one where he does every day of the week.
Do you have a book on?
Here it is here. It's called Around the Year with Emmett Fox. That's the one I'm into now. You want to hear something really freaky?
100%.
My daughter, Raydon Chong, you know, the actress, she's into a big fast, you know, because she gained a lot of weight, you know, hereditary and so on. Anyway, she's trying to get her weight down. So she's doing a fast. And a fast is very religious or very spiritual, because that's what Jesus talked about, you know, fasting. And so she came over because we got a little tradition of her reading to me. It started when I had cancer and I couldn't read. And so she would read my Emmett Fox books to me.
That's awesome.
And now it's a ritual. And so she always reads to me because she gets as much out of it as I do. And so she's doing this Fox fast. And so she goes to read to me and opens it up. And guess what? It's all about fasting. I mean, it was wow. It really blew my mind, because she just went telling me all the fasting, and then all of a sudden Emmett Fox talks about fasting. Oh, you'll love it. You'll love Emmett Fox, you know. And if you don't get it right away, don't push it, because sometimes you're going through stages in your life where you have to, you know, you have to learn certain things, you know, before you're ready to accept that kind of a truth, you know. And the other thing that Emmett talks about and all those spiritual books talk about is that you can't force or argue your ideas to someone else. You know, these are evolutions that you make. And, you know, it's like a musician, you know, like a jazz musician can't tell a guy that's just learning how to play a guitar. You really can't tell him anything other than to stay with it, practice.
Yeah.
You know.
Right.
And that's the same as spiritualism too. Unless you're unless you're ready to accept this knowledge, then it's best that you wait until you're ready.
There's a quote by Neil deGrasse Tyson. He says, "How strongly you feel about an issue is not itself a measurement of the strength of your argument."
Yeah, that sounds good.
So I have one last question, and then I'm going to head out of here. So tell me a little bit about Operation Pipe Dream and a headhunter.
Yeah, that actually comes up later too. Yeah, okay, that's a good question, Jake. That's a good question.
Pipe Dreams was created by, I guess, Ashcroft, Attorney General Ashcroft, during the Bush administration. The Bush people were getting ready to attack Iraq, but they were looking for an excuse. And so they were talking about the weapons of mass destruction. In the meantime, they had the DEA stalking me and a lot anybody in the marijuana industry or in the cannabis industry, especially the pipe makers, because we were the ones that were openly making pipes and selling them in stores. Even though pot was illegal, somehow the pipes were legal because they've been around forever. They're called water pipes, right? You know, and all you had to do was say they were for tobacco use only, and they were okayed. Well, the DEA started following me around to these different pot glass shops. And one time they're in Arlington, Texas, and the DEA, you know, they're kind of clumsy. They're kind of like Stadenko and Up in Smoke. You know, they were very obvious. You know, they're big athletic looking guys wearing headbands. And no one wears headbands except me in the movie. And so the girls at the Arlington pot shop put on t-shirts that said DEA. And then they would follow the DEA around wherever they went in their disguise. I never got the hint. I didn't figure that out. I thought they were other just customers. And so one of the DEA guys asked me, he says, "Can I talk to you for a minute?" And I said, "Sure." And he said, "Well, let's go outside." So we went outside. We sat down, and he had a backpack, and he had a camera recording everything. And he said to me, "These pipes, they're not just for tobacco use only, are they?" And I said, "No, hell no." He said, "Well, what are they?" I said, "They're for smoking marijuana." I'm being Mr. Honest. Anyway, a couple of months later, I get a knock on the door, and it's the SWAT team.
Wow.
SWAT team. And they come, and they wouldn't tell me why they were in the house. I thought they were after weed. And so they said, when they said, "Any marijuana in the house?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Where? Where is it?" I said, "Every room in the house." And then he said, "You got to get more specific." And I'm an honest guy. So I'm saying, "Any marijuana?" Okay. "Oh, there's a big bud on my workbench downstairs." And so he goes down, and he comes back a few minutes later. He says to his superior, he says, "I can't find it, sir." and so then I said, I said, "What kind of drug bust is this?" You know? He said, I don't have my dogs. I don't have my dogs." I said, "Well, what kind of drug bust is it? You know, come without dogs." And then it got to be like a comedy bit, because I was not scared because I'm not doing anything illegal, mm-hmm. You know. And so I'm walking around in my jockey shorts. So finally the guy goes, "Put some pants on this guy, you know, get some pants on him." So they took me up to the closet. They're putting on pants, and then they discover my strong box, you know, mm-hmm. With a lock on it. And they thought, "Oh boy, what's in here?" And I said, "Money. We sell t-shirts, and it was our t-shirt money." And so he made me open it, and they were looking for guns. They were looking for weapons. That's why the SWAT team comes. They look for weapons, because if you're involved in a drug bust with a weapon, then you automatically get 5 years added to your sentence, whatever it is. So they couldn't find any guns. And finally, my wife says, she got dressed, you know, they're searching, taking our computers and kind of ransacking the house kind of a little bit, you know. And so my wife says, she got all dressed up, we got her makeup. She says, well, let's go. I said, where are we going? She says, I got to get my coffee. And so the cop goes, just a minute, we're not finished here. And Shelby goes, are we under arrest? And he said, no. She says, okay, well, we're going to get my coffee. She goes, why don't you go in the, there's a kitchen, why don't you go make your coffee? And my wife literally said, fuck you, I need my Starbucks.
That's fucking awesome. Tommy, I'm gonna let you finish, but everybody starts laughing.
And then the lead cop goes, okay, that's a wrap. We're out of here. She literally drove him out of there, out of the house.
That's hilarious. Then
a couple of months later, you know, I go to court and I thought I was going to beat it because, first of all, it wasn't my company. Second of all, you know, we weren't doing anything illegal. So what they did, and they taped this too, the DEA went to our factory. First of all, they phoned them, and this is on tape. They phoned and they wanted us to ship some bongs to Beaver Falls, Pennsylvania. And we said, no, we can't do that because that's on the no fly list, you know, no bong list.
Right.
And so they came in person to our factory and then they ordered a bunch. And then I think they had an undercover guy in the factory because they had a couple already. They had me under surveillance for a year. And so a shipment got shipped to Beaver Falls. And that gave them shipping paraphernalia across state line.
Right.
And then that was against the law. But
wouldn't that be entrapment? Wouldn't that be illegal?
Oh, all of that. All of that. In fact, every legal person that I ever talked to said that I should have not been arrested. I should not have been charged. I should not have gone to jail. However,
it was when
the government wants your ass in jail, the government will put you in jail. And I was in jail with a lot of people that, you know, there was one accountant. He figured a way to beat the government out of taxes. Right. They put his ass in jail for 2 years for no reason other than the government wanted him in jail. And wow. and then they let him out, but you can't do that tax loophole again. So that's it. And the reason I got arrested or went to jail, I think the real reason was my name is Chong, and it's a racist. That's what I think, you know, looking at all the racism going on. But my lawyer told me, don't talk to anybody. Don't talk. You can't tell Tommy Chong to shut up. I mean, I got the biggest mouth in Hollywood, you know. I will talk regardless. And so I was going to court and they wanted the press wanted my comments, you know, what's the deal about being arrested for bongs, you know? And I said, well, the government, you know, my bongs were the only weapons of mass destruction they found.
Excuse me real quick before you continue. I think Jake needs to leave now.
Yeah, no, Jake, so, you gotta stay. Jake, you can't go.
I'm gonna be late for work. I wish
Jake,
I could.
Jake, quit your job.
Quit your job. Tommy Chong told Jake to quit his job.
Go, Jake. Okay, nice meeting your brother.
It's been great. Have a great rest of your day. I hope this podcast was great.
Have a good day, man. Have a good day.
Great to meet you.
See you, Jake.
See you guys.
So to carry on with what you were saying about Operation Pipe Dreams, we did a little bit of research into it. And from what we found, it says you were the only defendant who received a sentence with no prior convictions. Yeah. Also, the federal government stated that the reason you received such a harsh punishment was because of the comedy movie Up in Smoke and how it trivialized the government's anti-drug effort.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what we found.
Yeah, that isn't that funny? What, isn't this America with free speech?
Yeah.
Aren't you allowed to criticize the government? Aren't you allowed to criticize the police? You don't go to jail for that.
Yeah.
No, the reason I received a harsh sentence was because, well, first of all, you know what they did? They looked at my juvenile record.
Okay.
See, you're not supposed to do that. You know, the juvenile, when, whatever you've done when you're a juvenile, that's supposed to be sealed, forgot about. But I had a juvenile record. I got convicted of joyriding, which meant, that was also funny. A friend of mine stole the car. The car broke down. He called me up. I went over to where the car was broke down and tried to help him get it started. I wasn't doing anything. I'm not mechanical. So I was kind of standing there, like looking out. And then all of a sudden the cops pulled up. And so we ran. And we ran to my house and in the snow. And so the cops had to follow our tracks in the snow. And then they come in. I was 16 at the time. And they took us to jail. I spent the weekend in jail. And got out, went to court, got fined $100.
Wow.
For joyriding, and that was it. So when they looked at my record, they do this all the time. They're not supposed to, but they do. They look at your juvenile record, and that's what they did. They couldn't bring it up in court, but they found out that I had been hobnobbing with the shady side of law. And when you do that, well, then that's like, you know, so it wasn't really my first offense. It was, I had done it before. It didn't matter because I didn't, I turned the whole prison sentence into a religious retreat, basically. I was in a camp. I mean, I had more, it was beautiful. We had a running track. We had a football field. We had a any kind of sport you want to do. I got really into bocce ball. I didn't have to work unless I wanted to. Then I got a job in the garden because a buddy of mine had a fresh vegetable garden in the prison. And so we ate better than I did on the outside. Hey, when I left prison, I got this 2-hour haircut. the Chicano that did my haircut, hey man, this is a going away present. Give me 2 hours, a very special haircut. It was the best haircut I've ever had.
Wow.
And I was tan from laying in the sun. And I was skinny from working out. I looked like a Hollywood guy. And when my wife picked me up, she was, whoa. Because it was crazy, man. It looked like I'd been in some kind of spa for 9 months.
Right. Awesome. All right. Okay. So this is scheduled for 1 to 2, but I guess we wrote a bit of a big podcast. So
yeah.
Are you free for longer than 2, or should we just cut it down a little bit?
No, we go as long as you want. I don't have anything till 2, I think.
Awesome. Okay, cool. Great. That helps because we are just about to get into segment 2, but I believe Connor
I went ahead. Oh yeah, okay, yeah. So we all know that you played Leo in that 70s show.
Yes, okay, I'm sorry, Connor, just one thing. So Leo has a cousin named Eli, and I have a brother named Leo, so I always thought it was super funny that there was Leo and Eli in that 70s show, and there are a bunch of stoners, because me and my brother are.
Yeah. Leo had a cousin named Eli.
Yeah.
Wow. I don't remember that one.
Really? It was when you guys had to rearrange the basement, but you guys didn't do anything. You guys moved it like 2 inches to the left. He was like, I call it 2 inches to the left.
And that was Eli? That was...
Yeah.
Hey, you want to know something?
Yeah.
That was the only ad-lib I ever uttered in that show.
Really?
Every line I uttered in that show was written.
Wow.
What are you doing in Canada? All that stuff was written by writers. They were so in tune to us. And the only, it was the 2 inches that was the ad lib.
That's funny. All right. Anyways, all right, Connor, proceed.
So during that show, what was your favorite episode that you were on, like, while filming and stuff?
Probably the most memorable was the last episode when we knew we were doing it for the last time. And Kitty, instead of calling me Leo, she called me Tommy. She says, I'm going to miss you, Tommy. And everybody kind of looked at her. Mm-hmm. And she didn't catch it.
Wow.
it was so emotional for her, which was so cool because when I joined the show, she was the only one that really didn't welcome me with open arms, you know, because Kitty really is Kitty. And she thought I was that out of control, you know, that wasted stoner.
That's funny. That's great. All right. Yeah. And Murphy, do you have anything for the last part of the first segment?
My one last question is, what was your favorite movie to cameo in? Like just playing yourself in.
Good question. Because I did Silent Bob. I did. Half Baked. Half Baked. Yeah.
That was a good movie.
That was the first non-Cheech and Chong movie that I did. And that was a first for a lot of people, you know. David Chappelle, Hurt Locker, what's his name? That was his first movie. Yeah, there's a lot of, yeah. I didn't meet many people there because, you know, they had me separate. Yeah, it has to be Half Baked. That was the longest movie that I was in, too. Other than that, the rest, I'm, you know, little bits and pieces.
Eli, your mic.
I forgot.
You muted yourself.
Yeah, bad. I completely forgot. Okay, so we move on to segment two, career talk. All right, so as I said before we started all this, this is going to be like, you know, what we found online and through our own knowledge, and if it's true or not, and if we can get your side of the story. So the first one is in 1963, you and Bobby Taylor decided to open a nightclub in Vancouver, Canada called Blue Balls.
No, that's not true.
That's really? Not true.
That's not true.
No.
Wow.
Called what? Blue Balls?
Yeah,
that's what we found on the internet.
Yeah.
No, that's totally wrong.
Wow.
In 1963, Tommy Milton, Little Daddy and the Bachelors, we found a club and we named it the Blues Palace.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
The Blues Palace. And we opened the grand opening, we used Ike and Tina Turner. Was for the grand opening. So, and we were so successful, we got asked by the city to leave that spot.
Wow.
Yeah, we were closed down. Our success always closed us down and furthered my career, you know.
All right. And so the second question, Murphy Connor, would you like to take this one?
I'll do it. Okay, so you and the members of Little Daddy and the Bachelors, as far as we know, we read something. It said you guys got yourself billed as four N's and a C.
Well, no, it wasn't Little Daddy. It was a bar band.
It was a bar band. Okay.
Yeah, we never had a name. Little Daddy had left a long time ago.
All right.
I was with Bobby Taylor. And Leo and Freddie and Wes.
Wes Henderson,
and
yeah.
So there was four N's.
Yeah.
And myself. And what happened is that we had just been signed with Motown. And Motown wanted to know the name of our band for the contracts. And we never had a name. We were called ourselves, we were a bar band, you know, the Elegant Parlor, you know. Bobby Taylor singing at the Elegant Parlor. That was it. So we had heard about a band in Texas called 10 Screaming N's. And okay. So we thought, how about four N's and a C? and we laughed and we put it up on the marquee. And and that night we had no customers. Nobody wow. came. Nobody wanted to see four ends in a sea, except one very angry big, rough, black lady wrestler named Lottie the Body.
What?
Wow. And Lottie the Body almost killed my dad because Lottie was sitting there and we played. And then she goes, well, I see the ends real loud. She's, I see the ends, but where's the C? And my dad, who was a C, right. He came out and he gave her a little lecture, was started to, and she picked him up and body slammed him to the ground. Oh my God. And so then I ran down to help my dad, and she picked my ass up and body slammed me down. And all the ends were on stage laughing their ass off. And so my brother finally saved both of us. And so we had to change the name to four colored guys and a Chinese lad. And Motown, by the way, said, nah, we're going to call you Bobby Taylor and the Vancouvers.
Right.
Okay, so next thing. So you and your bandmate, Wes Henderson, you guys missed a Friday night performance to be able to get green cards to America, or as American citizens. After showing up late for the gig, Chris Clark and Johnny Bristle fired you. Barry Gordy later told you that you weren't actually fired and it was a mistake, but you decided to stay fired. What's your reasoning behind that?
Well, I told Barry Gordy, first of all, Bobby Taylor was separated from us, and our strength really was with Bobby Taylor. Chris Clark, you know, all of a sudden we became a backup band, you know, and and they started treating us like a backup band. And so when I we all got deported from Detroit earlier, and so I immediately went to Motown and said I need a green card. And they didn't know what a green card was, and they soon found out. And so they arranged for me to get a green card, the legal department in Motown. And so part of the thing is you have to show up for your meetings for immigration. You can't miss a meeting. If you do, they'll throw you off the list.
Yeah.
And so I told everybody, you know, well, I told Tom Baird actually was musical director. I told Tom that I'm going to have to miss and Wes too, because I was trying to get Wes a green card too. And then and so we missed the gig and we flew back and got the green card, or at least we got the meeting. And then when we flew back, this was interesting. When we flew back, first of all, there was no ticket for me. There was a ticket for Wes, but none for me. And so then I told Motown, I got my stuff there, you know, I have to go back. So I kind of had a feeling that something was going on. But I never thought they would fire me, because I was basically the leader of the group.
Yeah.
I created the group. But when I got back there, sure enough, they fired me. And the saddest thing was that none of the band, including Wes, none of them stuck up for me. None of them said, hey, that's wrong, man. If he goes, I go.
Wow.
Which I would have done, you know.
Yeah.
I would have said no, you know. But they all turned away. They all looked at me, and they wouldn't look. They wouldn't make eye contact with me.
Wow.
And so I said, "The hell with that." So I got my stuff. First time in my life I ever been fired from my own gig. And
wow.
So I grabbed my stuff, and I had my girlfriend with me at the time. That's another reason I had to go back. I had her and our month old baby in the motel. And so then we flew back to Detroit, and I was in a midnight theater, a 50 Cent theater, with my girlfriend, and we're watching a movie called I Love You, Alice B. Toklas. And wow, that movie changed my life. I said, look at California, man. All the hippies are there, and, you know, and sunshine. And if I'm going to be unemployed, hell, I might as well be unemployed in California. See, I had the nightclubs paying me, you know, so I had an income coming in. I wasn't depending on Motown at all. And so we moved to California, and then from California, moved up to back to Vancouver. And that's when I started the improv club, and that's where I met Cheech, and that's when I changed everything.
Wow. All right. Murphy, would you like to take the next question?
So after you and Cheech split up in 1985, you developed an unsold pilot for a show called The Martinez Family, later adopted into the 1988 sitcom Trial and Error. You're known as the producer on board on the show, but never appeared at any writing sessions. Can we get your side of that story?
It was it was kind of interesting because I lived next door to the president of CBS. His name escapes me at the time. Anyway, his wife was kind of crazy, and she would sneak into our yard and steal plants because I had bought a not marijuana plants, but I bought a house from this filmmaker that he bought from a lady that was one of the top botanists, had the nicest garden in Bel Air, one of the nicest gardens. It used to be on the tour, the garden tour. So I had this incredible garden that went up the mountain, side of a mountain, and it had a natural spring at the top, and it was just gorgeous. Anyway, the wife of the president would sneak over and steal plants. And my gardener caught her, saw her, and he told me about it. And so he knew that I knew that his wife was going stealing plants. And so when he was about to retire, he called me over to his house, and he said, you know, he thanked me for being, you know, understanding with the wife, you know. Yeah, it's a plant. Who gives a shit, you know? And take it. I'd give it to you. He asked me for it, you know. And so then he says, you know, it was, what do you call it? When you have a hit, when you're starting a TV show, the first show, what's it called?
A premiere?
Not a premiere, but it's not a sitcom yet, but it's going to be. Anyway, he said, how would you like a pilot? He says, how would you like to a pilot? And I hadn't thought about it. I said, yeah, you know, I never turned down anything. Yeah, I'm a collector. So when he gave me a pilot, and we eventually sold the pilot for $600,000.
Wow. But
I had to write it, you know? And so I wrote Family Martinez, and then they wrote, changed it to Trial and Error, and it never made it. I had some good ideas. I had a Chicano lawyer. It's going to be a Chicano lawyer dealing with the problems of the ghetto, you know, different problems, and like being arrested for being a Chicano, basically. It's almost like the Black Lives Matter kind of thing, because I always had a social conscience, but it never made it, you know. But I did the pilot, and we did make money off it, you know. We did okay.
And only 3 episodes were aired, right, out of 8, and there's 5 that were unaired of the show?
I have no idea. You know, I don't think I've seen 1 episode.
Really? That's funny. Okay.
I don't. Like I said, we sold it. We sold it to Castle Rock.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah.
Wow. All right. Okay, so the next question. Yes, this is the next question. All right. We did kind of find it funny that in the opening credits of Far Out Man, which is like your first movie without Cheech, I believe, it's labeled as a Tommy Chong attempt. And ironically, our first attempt at filmmaking is a road trip film with like friends and family being in it, and where you're just going across the country. And it's like our first attempt.
Yeah. Well, that's Far Out Man was my attempt, a Tommy Chong attempt.
Yeah.
And it had my son. It had my wife.
And your daughter.
And my daughters. And Bobby Taylor. That was the only movie Bobby Taylor was ever in. And what's his name? The comedian. He died. But anyway, oh, shit. I can't think of his name. I'm terrible with names now. I had an edible last night. But yeah, Far Out Man, I love it. You know whose movie is favorite is Sugar Ray Leonard, you know, the boxer?
Really?
Yeah, he was in a theater one time. He was the only guy there, and he was laughing his ass off. He loved that movie.
Awesome.
Wow.
All right. Yeah. So in the next one, so we kind of talked about this. That's why I'm just taking.
We can skip past the pipe dreams because we went into that a little bit.
Yeah. We already pretty much did that. So because it just follows. There's just a documentary. Okay.
That's cool. Okay. So our next question, up to our knowledge, you had an appearance on the 19th season of Dancing with the Stars. You were partnered with professional dancer Peta Murgatroyd, and you're known as the oldest participant to make it to the semifinals. Did you enjoy participating on Dancing with the Stars?
I loved it. I had to adjust. You know, it really was a wake up call as far as getting old. You know, up until then, I thought I could hang with the youngsters, but I couldn't. And so, I really enjoyed it. It was a career changing moment. It changed a lot of things in my life. You know, yeah, I really enjoyed it.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Eli, I know you love Trailer Park Boys. You want to take away the next question?
Oh, this is mine, dude. I don't know what you're talking about. It's Trailer Park Boys. Okay, so you had an appearance on Trailer Park Boys, Out of the Park USA. Did you enjoy being on the set with the Trailer Park Boys, you know, Rob Wells, Mike Smith, and J.P. Tremblay? And I was wondering if when the smokeout scene, were you guys really, like, smoking real weed and doing all the dabs when Ricky's, like, getting baked?
Real weed. Awesome. Real weed.
Oh, that's so sick. That is so sick.
All the time. Real weed. And I don't know if you noticed, but I kept making him smoke.
Oh, yeah, no. Yeah, he was like, oh, no, dude, it's your hit. You're hit. He's like, oh, shit. Okay. Great.
Because, you know, my instincts were to treat everybody like I would treat Cheech.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's great. Yeah, because Trailer Park Boys, that's like, honestly, one of my favorite shows. It's like That 70s Show, Trailer Park Boys, and Workaholics. Those are my favorite.
Yeah.
Freaking amazing.
A lot of fun.
All right. And then so the next one, we are going on the strain of the day. So for the strain of the day today is the Chong Star, which it was named in honor after you. It is a hybrid strain that is cultivated and sold by Marisol Therapeutics in Pueblo, Colorado. The effects have, you know, relaxed, happy, uplifted, and creative. It helps with stress, pain, anxiety, depression, and lack of appetite. As I said, it's a hybrid indica dominant. The THC levels are 17% to 23%, but we couldn't find the strain genetics as if it was mixed with anything.
Is there a question in there?
Well, we were wondering. Well, I was kind of wondering how to put in there. So with it says it's a hybrid. So I was wondering if how it was made, if you knew if it was mixed with any different plants at all.
No, I have no idea what they do.
Okay. But yeah, so yeah, usually we just have a strain of the day, and obviously we'd have to choose
smoke
something
break
in honor. Yeah. And so it goes to a little smoke break if anyone has anything to smoke.
Oh, is there a smoke break now?
Yeah. Smoke break.
Wait. Let's see. What do I got to do? Oh, I can't do it yet. I got to wait.
You have to wait?
I got to wait one more call. I got another. No, let's see. I think I got another podcast at 2:00.
Okay.
No, I better wait. I did, like I said, I did an edible last night. We
That's
cooked
okay.
Some banana bread pot. Bread.
Banana bread's my favorite.
Oh, dude, that'd be great.
Yeah, and it looks so good, but it was so loaded. I put out like as much weed as I could put in it, you know, and so it's time release, so it takes a while, but I'm still on that effect.
Well, our All next right. section kind of goes into us babbling for a while. So I want to ask first, is there anything more that you would like to talk about yourself?
Not at the moment. I can't think of anything.
All right. So this is RLB. It's kind of random life bullshit. You know, mainly just talk about, you know, what you're interested in, what you've been looking into, and you know, just your normal hobbies or interests. You know, like Elon Musk is building Starbase. That's like one of the things I've written down, and I don't know really anything about that, but I think it's kind of crazy that Elon Musk is like, hey dude, I'm just gonna build a city, like, see y'all later.
You mean my idea for Hippie Land?
Hippie Land. Hippie wait, Land. Hold up.
Explain
wait.
Into that. What's going on?
What? Hippie Land? I want to hear about that.
Hippie Land is my solution for the world that we live in now. I created Hippie Land in Far Out Man for a bit. It's an amusement park, you know, and one of the rides was Jimi Hendrix balls. He got in them and they went down. you got to check it out. Hippie Land to me is the answer for our immigration problem, our homeless problem, our work problem. It's all in one. Basically what it is, it's a movie that never ends. And so everybody in Hippie Land is employed by a movie company.
Okay.
And by when I say employed, I mean, when you do a movie, there's something to do for everybody.
Yeah.
No matter who you are, as long as you're breathing. And even if you're not breathing, even if you're dead, there's still a place they can put the dead body somewhere in the shot, and they can make use of it. But the great thing about a movie industry is that they are equipped to handle people's personal needs, housing and food. And, you know, when you go on a movie, you get a place to stay, and you get the food, all the food you need, and you get wardrobe. And so everything is taken care of. And you're also sectioned off into who you are. Actors over here, writers are over here, producers are over there, the crew is over here, the extras, there's a whole thing for extras. There's a whole thing for the art department. If we were to look at our homeless problem, for instance, in the form of a movie, you would leave them doing what they're doing. The only difference is that you would be paying them to be actors to do what they're doing. And when you become an actor, you also have to join all the guilds. You have to join the Actors Guild. If you're a director, you have to join the Directors Guild. And so in order to join these guilds, you have to show that you are capable of performing the different roles. And so by putting everybody into a guild or a union, you give them health benefits. Everybody's covered with their health and their dental and their housing, basically. And if there's something, you know, some serious thing happens to them when they're on the set or wherever, they're taken care of. There's people in a movie company, there's always someone to take care of somebody else. You know,
yeah.
And you have a hierarchy that depends what movies are going to be made and so on. Now, my idea of Hippie Land is to have, it's a project that never ends. But what you do, we take the plastic garbage that everybody has a problem, any kind of problem with the garbage disposal, for instance, we make a mountain out of it in some area that needs water and basically a forest. Because when you make a mountain, you can make a what do you call it? A green forest, a rainforest.
Mm.
You see, you need a mountain to create weather. And so you can, what I see is making a movie of us taking the stuff that we can't dispose of easily, like plastics,
right,
and then creating mountains around the planet, like they built the pyramids,
right,
you know, years ago. Well, we create these garbage pyramids or mountains, and what they are, the core is garbage, but the outside is soil and rock and so on, that the art department puts together. Now, a mountain can be a beautiful place to do recreation. And it's also a beautiful place to purify water, because we can pump ocean water up to the top of the mountain, or even to the base of the mountain, and reclaim it, you know, desalinization of it. But when you pump it up to the top of the mountain, then now you've got a water system, waterfalls, you got lakes, that'll create a lake, that'll create streams, that'll create water for the plants that grow on the mountain itself and in the valleys. Now, when you have a mountain, you can also, that creates valleys. And when you have valleys, that creates grow areas for crops to feed the people that live in hippie land.
And animals, and so, too.
Yeah. And it creates, because the way I look at it now, AI is going to eliminate all the shit jobs that are on the planet today. You know, anything that's repetition can be done better by robots,
yeah,
and you know, than can be done by humans. And so humans, now our job really is to create other humans, in other words, to keep our bodies healthy. So I see a mountain in all the poor countries of the world have this, the hippie lands, and that will create everything that you need, more than anything, atmosphere. Like the in Egypt, for instance, during the pyramid times, it was a lush jungle. You know, it wasn't a desert like it ended up right. being. It was a lush jungle, and that was because of the way the planet was going at that time. But what we have to do as a species, we have to create art. Art is what we have to create, and hippie land would be like an art colony. And by making it a movie company, now you got control and you got order
right.
with the unions and the so on that takes care of the people. And like a movie company, there should be the head of the movie company, you know, that can be voted in. And, you know, because you need qualified people to do everything.
Right.
Like in the weed business, you know, there was a lot of fear over big business taking over. Well, big business is nothing but guys that know how to deal with a lot of things at one time. That's what big business is. You know, it's someone that went to school that knows how to grow a ton of crops, you know, miles of crops. And that's what, and when it comes to marijuana, you need everything. And we got everything in the business. The only thing that we're lacking right now is the legal authority to do this. Now, if we do a movie, you bypass a lot of problems that you have with governments. Which governments, you get people voted in every couple of years or every 4 years, you see. With a movie company, you can have the same guy in the position for his lifetime. And then he can pass that down to someone else who's just as qualified. So I see, personally, I see the movie company on a humanitarian scale, in a ecological scale. And for instance, the kids that were imprisoned at the border, you know, I see a movie company taking individual families and then tracing their roots all the way back to the beginning and tracing their and making a movie of it, you know, and then seeing how they do. Okay, they were incarcerated at the border. Now it's 10 years later. Where are they? It's 20 years later. What are they doing? How many became doctors, lawyers, and politicians, and so on? And so that's my plan. It's ambitious, but it's totally workable, because America, what made America powerful is that anybody can do what I'm doing. You know, you don't get stopped. I couldn't do this in China. In fact, if I went to China, the fact that I'm Chong and they'd look up my record like you guys did, I would be in jail, you know, or executed, you know. And that's what I love about America, is that that we have those freedoms.
Wow. Eli, your microphone's muted again.
Sorry, I'm sorry. Okay. Because if I drink or something, I don't want it to be too loud. I just thought of this. I remember reading an article, or it might have been watching an interview or something. You said when you tripped on ass with your wife the first time, you knew that, like, you knew that she was going to be your wife, but she wasn't your wife at the time. Is that true?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. My first wife, I met when we put our band together, and she was very young. She was 15 at the time. And I just hung around, and we were boyfriend, girlfriend. We were, you know, estranged. You know, she grew up, I grew up. This is my first wife. And then I went on the road, became, you know, the musician and all that. And when she turned 20, I guess it was, my first wife, she decided that she wanted to be us to get married. We weren't really together. I was always on the road.
Right.
And I always had all sorts of other action going on. I never in love with anybody, but I was definitely in love with my first wife, you know, Maxine. And so we got married, and we had a couple of kids, and then I met my present wife, Shelby. Again, she was 16 at the time. I was at a gig. She came, we were on the beach, and I saw her come out of the, walking up with her little brother. and I just, wow, I fell in love with her, just how she looked. She looked tanned and blonde, and she was a dream. Gorgeous to know. Not gorgeous, but she had this shitty attitude that I just fell in love with. what attracted me to her, besides her beauty and that, was the fact that she did not want to talk to me.
That's funny.
She wanted to talk to the singer. She wanted to talk to anybody but me. But I was in her face all the time. And finally, like all beautiful girls, she figured she found a slave. You know,
right?
You know, if you're going to hang around, well, then do something for me. so she has, and still has, this incredible business sense. Mm-hmm. From a child, from the youngest, she was always had. She's part Jewish, and she's half Jewish, and whoa, I mean, and she's like the Jewish dream. She's part Jewish, and she's got incredible legs.
Murphy here is Jewish too. Incredible. He keeps everything, body. Every box. He keeps every single box.
Yeah, she is gorgeous, but she's got a brain, and she was the one. She is really responsible for Bobby Taylor and the Vancouvers, because when I we first hired Bobby, he was like a loose cannon, you know. In fact, he left without notice, and tried to steal the drums. We had a drum set that we bought for him, and my brother caught him and said no, but he left the group. And when he wanted to come back, it was Shelby that said, you know, because, you know, the guy, he let us down. We get him a second chance. And Shelby said, absolutely. You know, he can sing. He'll pack the club. And so we hired Bobby again. And sure enough, then we got everything in my life, including my look, was because of Shelby, because of my wife. Wow. She hated the way I looked. She wouldn't look at me. After I met her at the beach, then she came and saw the band at the gardens in Vancouver. And again, she came up, her and her sister, and they wanted a ride for us to give them a ride to another club. We had our own club, but they were going to go to the hot club, you know, not our club, but the hot club.
Right.
And so So we said, but when she got in the car, the first thing she did, do you know what a dickie is? It's a phony turtleneck sweater.
Oh, okay.
Back in the day,
yeah,
our band uniform was dickies. We all wore dickies. And she got in the car and she wouldn't look at me. I was in the back seat and Floyd or something was driving. Tommy was driving. And I'm in the back seat and she was looking out the window. She wouldn't look at me. And finally, she, without looking at me, she goes, "Take off that dickie." And I, what? I just met her. And she's telling me, take off that dickie. And so, so I took it off. And then she said, "Give me some popcorn." My heart went poof. I fell in love with this lady. Because up until then, you know, the guy's in charge, you know, and the girl's polite. First bitchy woman I met, man, I just, oh. I was smitten because it's so cute, you know. So I got her popcorn and then just drive us to the club. And so we drove her to her and her sister to the club, dropped them off. And then we went to our club. It was empty. Our club was kind of sad. It was empty. And we were down there. We're playing away. And next thing you know, there's a commotion at the door. We're in the basement. And the commotion up there. And I look. And there she is. She couldn't get in the other club. She was too young and barefoot, I think. And so she said to everybody standing around there, they're all going in her, you know, looking at her and thinking, "Wow," you know, and she goes, "Well, I know a club we can get into." And everybody said, "Where?" And so she brought that whole hot club down to my club. And my club stayed full from that day on. That day on, it was packed because all they needed to do was find out where the hot club was. And we were friends. We were just friends for many years. Well, until she was 20, I guess. Yeah. 16, 17, 19. Yeah, 4 years, just friends. And then we took acid together. Or at least I took acid.
Okay.
And then we made love for the first time. And she got pregnant for the first time.
Wow.
And we've been together ever since.
That's awesome.
Wow.
Yeah. All right. So we're just take up a little bit more of your time because we'll move on to the very last segment, which I like to call the movie spit. And it's mainly just about, you know, movies that, you know, maybe you've done or you want to talk about or just movies we like. But I would actually like to ask a couple questions because we have a movie coming out and it's called The Fuck It List, kind of like The Bucket List. But fuck it, we're just going to do it. And I was wondering if, you know, you could give us any pointers because you made a road trip movie and we're going from Minneapolis to Las Vegas. And at the very end, well, I'm not going to say what the very end is, but it's going to be pretty crazy. And but it's just gonna be in the middle of the desert pretty much. But I was wondering if you could give us any pointers on making that movie.
Well, it's hard to give any pointers without, you know, seeing the movie.
Right.
In fact, but the only pointer that I give anybody is work with the best people you can work with.
Right.
You know, the work with people that know what they're doing.
Yeah.
You know, and don't be afraid to hire people that do one job and then want to move up. You know, that's what I did in next movie. There was a cameraman right away when he heard I was doing a movie, he contacted me. He says, "Yeah, I'm a cameraman, but I want to be a director of photography. And here's my da da da, you know, everything." And so I hired him and it was the best move I could make, you know, at that time.
Right.
Because when you give anybody a chance, actors, directors, anybody a chance, the first, and they're qualified, right, and you give them the first shot, then they will give you 120%.
Right.
They'll give you way more than you asked for because it's not repetitious. This is new.
Right.
And you want to get new energy. It's that new thrill, you know.
Yeah.
Because what happens to people when they do it too many times, it becomes a ritual. And when and rituals always require certain things that aren't really necessary for the project,
right.
You know, and like there's when we did Up in Smoke, we had a director, and he had directed hit movies before, and he just wanted to dick around the first part because that's what they do usually. They burn up a lot money, you know, just trying to get in the mood,
okay,
kind of thing. And when we did like their first shot of the day might be one or two maybe, just to get the feel, get going, because it's going to be a long haul,
right?
Well, when I did next movie, which was my first solo directing movie, I hired a first-time DP. We did 42 setups in one day. I think we broke a record.
That's awesome.
We did a big chunk of the movie in one day. We just went from one gag to another gag and another thing set up. It was incredible. 42 setups. It was unbelievable. And I haven't done it since. So what you want to do is, first of all, it starts with the script.
Oh yeah,
it starts with the script. Well, with Cheech and I, it started with Cheech and Chong, but we had done say 9 albums, which was 9 scripts.
Yeah.
You know, we did 9 scripts, all different, and we just had to pick one out of that 9 albums, and it was the Pedro and Man. And so you don't fool yourself into thinking that you can, you know, sort of improv your way through, because you can't. There's too many variables in a movie.
Right.
So hire experts. That's my advice.
Hire experts. Okay. See, I don't even know who we're going to hire, because we're pretty much just, it's me, Connor, Jake, and Murph. And that's pretty much our team.
When you put out the word you're doing a movie, you're going to get a ton of people saying they want to be part of it.
Oh yeah, I was sitting talking to my sister. We were just chilling and talking. We were smoking a bowl, and I just get this call, and she's like, "Hey, I'm looking for a film production company in Texas." I'm like, "It shouldn't be filed in Texas. It should be in Minneapolis." But like, what's up? And she's like, "I was wanting to do a what is it called?
Internship."
Yeah, an internship. I was like, oh, well, I can't provide an internship at the moment, especially since it's going to be in Minneapolis. But, like, I'll let you know. And it was so crazy for someone to call me and ask for an internship at my film production company that I'm just starting. And it was so crazy.
Oh, no, that's the way it goes. That's the way it goes. As soon as you know, they smell it.
Right. See,
yeah, we've been in a
want,
company
you,
for
you want that energy. You yeah. want that energy. You want that. You know, like I call it New York energy.
Really?
A New York actor will always come to a reading the day before.
Okay.
And he will have memorized the script. He will have, and he'll know the history of the director and whoever's involved in the picture. But he always shows up a day early. And then the casting director goes, "Oh, you're a day early. Right. What's your name again?" And then the guy says, and then she checks it and goes, "Okay, no, you're due here tomorrow." And so the guy says, "Oh, and by the way, how's so-and-so, the director?"
Right.
"Oh," and then the casting director says, "Oh, you know him?" "And well, no, I just know a lot about him." And so you show off that way.
Right.
And so then when you show up for the real audition, they know who you are.
Right.
And so that's George. Yeah, come on in, George. Yeah, George was. Oh, yeah, George asked about you.
Right.
You know, you know so and so. Yeah. And so and then they say, "Okay, okay, let's read George." And George say, "What do you want me to read? I know the whole script." The guy goes, "Oh, really? Well, why don't we try this and that?" And then so instead of getting like a bit part, all of a sudden George is he's on the board for maybe the lead or maybe the second or whatever, you know. So that's the New York version. That's how New York people work all the time.
Okay, awesome. And so I also want to bring something else up because, you know, it's crazy hearing that. And then I'm on the phone with Connor at 4 a.m. I go, I'm going to email Tommy Chong. Okay, I'm going to do it. I want him on my podcast. It'd be absolutely amazing. And I find the email on your Instagram. I end up getting the your manager's, and it actually happens. And it was like the most mind-boggling thing at the fact that I'm actually talking to Tommy Chong because I grew up watching you and everything. It was just insane. It was like, holy fucking shit, this can't actually be happening. And then I see Tommy Chong's iPhone pop up and I let you in, and it was insane. It was so crazy.
Well, that's what, see, yeah, that's how you do it, man. That's how you don't have to be from New York to you know, it's energy.
Yeah,
everything works on energy, you know, and it's the kind of energy that you put up with something that you really love.
Yeah.
You know, something that you have to do, then you put out that energy, man. Yeah, that's so cool. Whatever you do.
I have one question.
Yeah.
Have you listened to any of our podcast episodes before you've come on?
I doubt that.
No.
I wouldn't expect it. I really wouldn't. No, I was surprised you joined.
I'm usually too busy doing podcasts to listen to them. My son probably has.
Okay.
No, he's my eyes and ears, you know.
Right.
He'll tell me, he'll put me hip to everything, you know.
Yeah, I was like, I guarantee like someone check this out.
Yeah, yesterday he had me up with Rex Chapman, and I didn't know anything about Rex Chapman. Of course, my son did all the research, found out he's, you know, ex-basketball player and all that. And so, he's the one that's because I'm his meal ticket, you know. He's really keeping Dad alive and current, you know, anything.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Honestly, yeah. I was not expecting you to even like for this to work. It was like, I know the world is just going to fuck me over. I know it's going to happen.
I think that's really awesome, though, that you went out on a limb and joined us.
Yeah, that was awesome.
You guys are the future, man. You're actually not only the future, you're the present.
Yeah,
you know, and like I say about energy, you know, you guys are looking for to make it. That's the kind of energy that's so valuable, you know.
Right.
Time goes by so fast, man.
Oh, I know.
I mean, you guys, you know, 4 years or 5 years, it seems like an eternity, but with me, 20 years, it seems like yesterday, you know. I'll be telling stories and the guy will go, oh, I was born in 92. Oh, really? When were you born? What's your birthday?
I was born in 03.
03?
Yeah.
See, I'm going to jail. You're just popping into the world.
Yeah, pretty much. No, wow. Of course not. No. Yeah, no. But so whenever I watch movies, okay, there's like a certain grain to old movies, you know, there's that feel to it, you know what I mean? And that's what I want to make again, because there's all these film companies that are making these movies for money and not the fact that they want to make a good movie. And that's what I want to do. I want to make a good movie so people can watch it and, like, you know, they could be like, oh yeah, I used to watch this movie with my friend when I was, you know, like super young. And, you know, they can like have that nostalgic feel like I used to about the movies I grew up watching. And I want to be able to produce that. And people don't really, I don't feel like they care enough about film production enough anymore. And I feel like I want to be able to put that out there.
When you're working with experts, you know, craftsmen, because that's what a movie is.
Right.
A movie is you're dealing with reality and you're showing reality in such a way that people are going to be interested in seeing it. Now, there's certain rules that you got to be aware of. You don't have to follow them per se, but you have to be aware of, and you can't not see too many movies,
right?
You know, you see, that's what people ask me, you know, I watch everything because I learn off everything.
Right.
Last night I watched an old movie called Big Country. And it was starring Charlton Heston as a bad guy, Chuck Connors, the rifleman, as another bad guy, Burl Ives as the matriarch or the patriarch of a family, and he's another guy, famous guy. I can't think of his name, but he's another famous guy. And Gregory Peck was the star. And it's called Big Country. Well, you got to see it for the photography. Oh my God.
Was it amazing?
Well, it was so big country. Right. And they showed like a road that goes through the prairies. I don't know where they found this property. But back then, yeah, I guess it was near in Utah or somewhere. But
really?
Couple years back,
the scenery was just mind-boggling. Now the acting was also interesting.
Really?
It was interesting because you got Gregory Peck, you got top guys, and the writing. I was mesmerized by the writing because it was corny in so many ways, but the way they used people. First of all, the town was in the middle of the prairie. There was nothing but this settlement. In like a Western town. And then they had the canyons and the rocks and the shooting and that. Man, of course I get stoned all the time. So to me, when I'm watching movies, it's the best movie I've ever seen.
Right.
And I tell people about it. And then they go, man, especially my son, he didn't like it. I'll tell you a movie that my favorite movie of all times is a movie called Badlands. With Martin, Martin Sheen and Sissy Spacek. And it's a story of Charlie Stark, serial killer. And that's all I want to tell you. Badlands.
Okay.
Check it out.
Yeah, it's inspired by real life killers Charles Starkweather and Carl Ann.
That's it.
This tale of crime and love begins in a dead-end town. Teenage girl Holly angers her father when she begins dating an older and rebellious boy. After a conflict between Holly and her father erupts in murder, the young lovers are forced to flee. In the ensuing crime spree, they journey through the Midwest of the Badlands of Montana, eluding authorities along the way.
Go see it. See it. Yeah. Okay, another one. Let me give you another one.
All right.
The Traveling Executioner. The Traveling Executioner with Stacy Keach.
Traveling Executioner.
Yeah. Stacy Keach, I think Bud Cort. I think it was Bud Cort. But Traveling Executioner. Oh my God. Another freaky, freaky movie.
All right. Yeah. An executioner seduced by a woman marked for his portable electric chair in the 1918 Deep South.
Yeah.
That's all there is on it. Wow. Yeah. That's an old movie. That's 70s. Oh, man, I love old movies, dude. They're so much better.
Oh, when you see that, man. Oh, yeah, the 70s, you're right. Oh, my God. I mean, they went to places. And, it's still relevant, there's so many. And then you see what's so-called commercial. You know, the movies I never really got into was the superheroes,
right?
Other than I seen the black one, the Black Panther.
Yeah,
I seen that just out of curiosity of the most highest grossing movie ever, in the history of movies. So I had to see it, and there was parts of it I loved everything else, but yeah, when you see those Badlands and Executioner. What's another one? There's another really cool one that I'll think of it. But those two, man. The first one, the Badlands.
Badlands and the Traveling
Executioner. It was playing in Boston when we were doing a comedy club at Paul's Mall. And it was playing in a little theater, a little artsy theater downstairs. And I would, every day, I seen that movie every day for 2 weeks. I just sit through it over and over and over
That's
again.
Awesome.
Yeah, it was so good. The music. Well, it's who did it?
Badlands. Oh, let me check for you real quick. The director was Terrence Malick.
Well, any of Terrence Malick's movie. If you've seen what's that one? But anyway, check it out. Okay, guys, I'm getting close to.
Yes, that is actually perfect. We just ended the last segment, so yes, we can let you go.
Thank you very much for coming on.
Let me go now.
Yes, we can.
Am I free to go?
Yes.
Okay, my cool buddies. Let's see. Let's do it again. Okay.
All right. Awesome. Totally. No. 100%. Definitely.
Okay. Whenever you're ready, you let me know.
All right. Yeah. Thank you, man. So, thank you for everyone for watching. Guest star Tommy Chong, episode 3, March 11th. All right. Thank you, Tommy.
Okay, brother. Take care now.
Yeah. Peace out.
See ya.